This is John McGuire, and you are listening to Pentimental on SyncBook Radio. Today, on episode number 8, we have joining us for a one-on-one conversation, counselor and author Mary Rodwell, as well as a trialogue with naturalist and alternative researcher Mike Cleland. This week, we explored the question of extraterrestrials and ET consciousness from an unorthodox perspective. While much contemporary research focuses on the nuts and bolts empiricism of the UFO-ET phenomenon, there are others exploring the transpersonal and transformative nature of these perplexing accounts. The fundamental question is, are these experiences nothing but hallucinatory delusions, or is there an ontological, psychophysical reality to them worth mapping out? Thanks again to my guests this week, and thank you for listening. Show that I record here, it's called Pentimental, and in so many ways it does focus on altered states of consciousness. And I don't like to necessarily rigidly or dogmatically define what that means, because there are so many ways to enter, again, like these spiritual transformative experiences. And your avenue into that, the ET or whatever that is, again, it's just showing a different dynamic to this individuation process, this getting in touch with your higher self, whatever you want to call it, archetypal. But the ET is just so often, it's so surrounded by conspiracy theory and these ideas about men from Mars that I feel it's not muddying the waters. It's a valid avenue to pursue and think about. But when it becomes dogma, it's ridiculous. So I'm glad to be talking to you, who actually take it in a much different direction and get in touch with, again, what's the transformative element of it.
Well, yeah. So that's really the focus then, John, is actually showing how that connects to consciousness itself, which is in fact really where I've been going almost from the start when I was seeing the changes that having these forms of experiences, you know, in people in so many different ways, which still wasn't really being looked at. There was still more, you know, nuts and bolts ufology is still about, you know, lights in the sky and how can we prove that that picture is valid and how many witnesses and what size was it and all the rest of it. And to be quite honest, that is to me really immaterial, because what really is happening is these intelligences are interacting with us. So what is that about? Because that's the important thing here.
Right. Maybe the mainstream perspective on UFOs, it reflects this sort of literalist Judeo-Christian sense of how we view the world. So again, we're taking all this highly symbolic, highly metaphorical, highly spiritual messaging and trying to externalize it and turning it into something outside ourselves. And of course, there's that interaction between inner and outer, but it's more transformative. And again, what's the majority of these experiences and what are the patterns? And again, I like that you focus on this pattern question. Before we get too deeply, though, you know, we've already started the conversation. That's all good. But before we get much further, Mary, why don't you introduce yourself a little bit, give us a little perspective on who you are, where you've come from, and the work you do at what's called ACERN, or the Australian Close Encounter Resource Network.
Okay. Well, as Mary Rodwell, I'm the principal of the Australian Close Encounter Resource Network, which was something I created in 1997 after I'd had a number of people come to see me with what I now call encounter experiences, call it contact, call it experiencing anomalous events, however they are translated or understood by the individual. My background is nursing midwifery. I was drawn into learning to be a counselor through a number of synchronicities, and I found that far more useful in terms of looking at healing, because I now really understand, or at least feel I understand, the reason for a great deal of illness is due to our well, you know, how we feel about ourselves and our psychological, emotional state. So that really appealed to looking at the cause of illness rather than dealing with the effects of illness or whatever. From that, I've really worked in many different areas in counseling, from grief and bereavement, hospice, you know, the whole area of human relationships. But what was interesting with all of that, particularly in the grief and bereavement area, is people having experiences where they would perhaps be aware of someone who'd passed on, still communicating with them, still having interactions with them on some level, which has always made me, I suppose I've always been, very curious about the whole thing to do with who we are. What are we here for? What is life about? You know, all those big, deep questions that for me are the mysteries. You know, it never made enough sense to me that we got born. You know, we ended up getting married, having a family, growing more frail just as we starting to get a handle on what life is about, and dying. And I thought, well, you know, in my religious Catholic upbringing, that was it. And it actually became more and more confusing to me and less relevant in the way that I was hearing people that had experiences with past lives, for example. And then when I did hypnosis, I discovered that people were often going back into what they perceived as a past life, to an origin of particular phobia or particular thing that was happening. It seemed to happen again in this life, and understanding that. So all of that opened up my parameters to a point where, what is reality? What is consciousness? Why are we here? You know, those, as I say, those mysteries. And then synchronously, as I find so many synchronicities in life, when you become aware of them, I'd read a couple of books on the whole thing to do with abductions about a couple of months before my first client came to me. And I'm pretty certain that was all set up now, the way that I look at it. And one was by Dr. John Mack, Abductions, Humans, Encounters with Aliens, mm-hmm. former professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. So his credentials were immaculate, mm-hmm. Who was saying this is real. And then reading a book, the classic by Whitley Strieber, Communion, of his own experiences. This is an author and writer of sci-fi who was saying this is real too. So when Ellis Taylor, who was my very first client, who is an author himself now, came to me and said, Mary, I've heard you're open-minded. This is what's been happening to me. I wake up with marks on my body. The whole family's experiencing things. Relatives won't come to the house because they think it's demons. You know, can you help? And he said, because everyone, there's no support groups for this. Everybody thinks you're a loony. And that was the beginning. As they say, the rest is history. I was doing advanced counseling at the time. And in that, I actually took him as a case study in supervision. And that supervision group was, you know, social workers, psychologists, uniting minister, a whole range of professionals doing advanced counseling. And I presented his case rather with trepidation, I might add, because it wasn't your standard, I'm not getting on with my wife,
right?
Kind of thing. And what happened with that was, what was fascinating to me, and now I understand it even more, is not one of them suggested Ellis was crazy. They all said, oh, you know, I've had interesting things happen to me, and I was in a house that was haunted. And so what my case study did was open the doorway for them to start to talk about their own unusual experiences. So that was a revelation to me. They weren't saying, well, Mary, I think this guy ought to go and see a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. Maybe it was the way I'd done the case study. Maybe, you know, the different hypotheses. And I was saying, look, this is his whole family. So it plainly isn't just one guy going, you know, round the bend as you know, or going crazy, because yeah, they're all experiencing things. And so it was a family affair. And what that did show me was traditional psychology was not prepared to go there, because if they couldn't give me any answers, what was the point of doing that? So I looked to America and Dr. John Mack's Institute and another academy of clinical close encounter therapists, which doesn't operate anymore, sadly, of professionals that were supporting this. So really that started the ball going, because after Ellis, 2 weeks later, I got another lady. I ended up setting up a support group, And from that, really, my research has always been the therapist first, the researcher second, because to me, it's one thing to research this from all these different perspectives, but the thing that gives evidence of a reality, as far as I'm concerned, despite, you know, the millions of, you know, wonderful photographs of craft and whatever, whether you want to believe they're real or Photoshop, doesn't really matter. When you go into the truth embargo, you know how much of this is being covered up. But the evidence of an experience is the fact that this experience changes people, and hallucinations don't change people, and this does. And that was what intrigued me, because there is your reality in front of you. You know, the reality is that if an experience changes you in some amazing or transformative way, then it has a reality. And you know, you can walk around that as many ways as you like, but these people become more intuitive, more psychic. They often get wanting to start healing, using, you know, energetic work. They start writing strange scripts. They may come out with these unusual, what I call star languages. Their whole perspective on what matters in life changes, changing from a materialistic point of view to a more holistic point of view. There are many, many different patterns of shift in their awareness and consciousness that are a direct result of their encounters with these intelligences. And, you know, whatever that intelligence is, from the, you know, the physical to the interdimensional to the transdimensional to those that I believe may very well be coming from what we would call our future, even though I now believe that time is a physical third dimensional construct and actually not the way we truly operate in a multidimensional world. And so that's a long way of giving an introduction, I'm afraid, John.
No. That's exactly what I was looking for there. So I guess the best way to characterize your work is that, again, it's trying to help people integrate these experiences more so than just treating them as case studies. I mean, you're actually trying to help them progress down that road and taking their experience seriously and not just saying, hey, you're delusional, take some medication. Is that about right?
That's absolutely right. And that's why I wrote the book Awakening, was as a resource to help people integrate that experience rather than deny it. Because I found that the greatest problem has been people who've had an experience and still are so skeptical of its reality, simply because around them, everybody is unhappy with them by even mentioning it, or may laugh or mock them, or just go to the point where they don't even want to talk to them about any of it. But this is life-changing for many people. And if they can't look at it and explore it and understand it, then they're constantly in that conflict of what's real. And so to actually allow themselves or give them the information they need to put this into a box that they can manage so that they can start to integrate it within their lives, it doesn't mean that they're ending up, you know, going crazy. It actually means they become more balanced and more integrated when they realize that they can accept this and still operate in a third dimensional world. You know, you don't have to let go of one to embrace the other. You actually can bring them together and operate in a perfectly healthy way. Part of the problem is when you don't do that, when you're constantly in denial, you're constantly in conflict.
Now, you mentioned John Mack there, and I'm sure some people that are listening are already familiar with John Mack. And again, you've already kind of alluded to what his focus was, but maybe can you talk a bit more about what his work demonstrated and how it was so different in the context that he was working in?
That's a very good question. I mean, he's a hero of mine. I met him only the once a few months before he was, you know, killed in an accident in London. What I loved about the way that he looked at it was that he'd done, I don't know how many case studies. I mean, I think it was over 100 at the end of the day. He wrote two books. One was Abduction. The other one was Passport to the Cosmos. Mm-hmm. And by doing all the psychological testing was done, which, you know, to satisfy anyone who is extremely skeptical, he really made sure that every person that he was working with was considered what we would say is psychologically balanced and sound. From that, then, when he'd done all of that, he was working with their experiences through hypnosis in the same way I do. And again, he was looking at how this changed people. So the difference between a lot of the, what I call the nuts and bolts, is even the hypnotherapists, researchers that have been involved in this field that have done hypnosis, but are not therapists, that have done it more as, you know, a curiosity, or they've done it more to find out what happens on the craft or whatever, but not necessarily how it has changed the individual. He looked at how it actually changed the individual, and that was very much in line. So he was looking at it from a consciousness perspective, and that is why I think he was way ahead of his time in many ways compared to when he was still around. We had a lot of well-known researchers that were writing from a far more third-dimensional materialistic point of view, that were just seeing this from one baseline, whereas what I have discovered is that when you do hypnosis, there are many levels you can go to. You can go to seeing the scene. In other words, okay, so you're on a spacecraft and you're seeing some procedures done, etc. Well, now you know you've had experiences, off you go, which is about as useful as showing somebody a traumatic event and saying, yeah, it really did happen to you, off you go. Or actually saying, now let's look at this and find how that's affected you, or what does it mean to you, and how can you heal from that? And there's been many researchers that, because they haven't got a therapeutic base, have done just that and have left the person far more traumatized. And it's like doing the x-ray without doing the surgery. I'm putting it in medical terms. That's exactly what many of them have done, and left people even more traumatized. My job is to assist people through the process, not only of knowing what happened in the way that is healthy for them, but also maybe looking at the deeper part of what that means to them. And there are many ways you can take somebody in hypnosis to a part of them. I call it the part of them that knows, and talking to that part of them that knows, okay, so what is this saying to you? What does this mean to you? What is this, you know, what is it about? And they can often find understanding why procedures are done. What is their part in that cooperation or that interaction with this intelligence or these intelligences that they are interacting with? So it changes their perception of what this is all about.
One of my favorite books that really introduced me to this whole intersection between ETs and spirituality is a book called Supernatural by Graham Hancock. And he too draws very heavily on John Mack. I mean, John Mack was clearly the inspiration for that book. And what that demonstrates is, again, there's these strange, even spooky intersections between ET and what might be called the shamanic experience, which is possibly the oldest spiritual tradition on Earth. And of course, they're not always the same. They take on different characters throughout different cultures. So, for example, in Iceland or in one of those Nordic countries, you might have people more fixating on fairies or gnomes or something to that effect. But in essence, we still have these same kind of extra-dimensional, extraterrestrial beings that are sort of, I don't want to say interfering with someone's life, but definitely playing some role in it that's sort of unseen and below the surface. And then in our culture, which is perhaps more technologically fixated, we see this fixation on spaceships and humanoids that look like us, but are sort of perversions of us, like the grays with the big eyes and the skinny bodies. And they seem to have this otherworldliness to them, but at the same time, they don't quite seem as physical and all that. So do you notice any intersections there? Do you take those parallels seriously, or do you see them as completely separate?
Oh, I think you're spot on. It was interesting. I took part in a study in Western Australia with a gentleman that was doing his thesis on the comparisons between shamanism and abductions. Simon Harvey Wilson, sadly, he's not with us anymore. But what he concluded after he worked with various numbers of my clients in doing this study with Ida Cowan University, and what he concluded was the parallels were amazing between the shamanistic experience and the experience with abductions. Was, you know, the outcomes were healing, becoming more aware of multidimensional realities, interacting with different kinds of beings that would present themselves in a form that would be relevant to the individual in some way. Because we know that a lot of these, you know, experiences, they will use screen memories, like the owl as a screen for a gray, for example, Santa Claus for another screen for a gay, owls with big eyes would be, you know, when they looked at them, they would actually see they weren't an owl, for example. Right. So what I think with, we know with the shaman, one of the things they have to do is transcend their human fears to become able to operate in a multidimensional reality. And in many ways, it is exactly the same with those that have the abduction, more fear-based ones. And I will say here, only 30% of my clients have that type of experience. Many of them have completely different, very benevolent experiences with many of their contacts, which is quite different to the abduction. So that's another part of this. But with those that have the abduction experience, they too are being challenged to transcend their human fears, to become able to accept and operate in their multidimensional reality. So it's exactly the same kind of process. I call it the modern day shamanic experience, because, you know, as you say, we're a technological society. But of course, all the indigenous tribes and all the indigenous peoples, I mean, from India right through, you know, they will see them as gods. You know, in India, it is, you know, the blue being, you know, is everything from Shiva to, you know, the god. A lot of them are blue beings. Well, people see blue beings, they see manta beings in Australia. The Aborigines call the mantid being, which is like a praying mantis. They call it that the mamu, who teaches them things. The Hosa in South Africa call them the praying mantis beings. That they actually say the one who teaches. So it's all there. It's right through every culture. It's just that Western society has become so materialistic, and you know, the consensus third dimensional reality is saying unless you can touch, feel it, smell it, and it's not there, it's not real, leaves us in this huge confusion about our multidimensional nature, our intuitive, creative side that is giving us information on all sorts of levels. But most of the time, we are educated or programmed out of trusting it.
Right, because we're steeped in this sort of behavioralist psychology tradition that has the most academic momentum, because again, it can give you the most quantifiable data, and then that's tied to funding. And so there are all these socioeconomic and political factors that play into what belief systems we adopt that are totally disconnected from whether they're valid or not. So the transpersonal side, these ET side, the shamanic side is thrown into the dustbin, not because it's less convincing or less weighty in terms of the evidence behind it, but in terms of that, it's the quantifiableness, or whether it can be quantified, is always the question. And so in this, like you said, this materialist culture we're in, it's dismissed just based on those kind of superficial reasonings.
Yes. And this is my big issue with present psychology in terms of Western psychology, is that it's still not allowing for the fact that we are multidimensional in nature, in terms of all these different experiences that people are now coming out more and more about. And I mean, I've worked with over 3,000 individuals all around the globe, families and children that have talked about their experiences and what have you, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences. They're commonplace. And yet it's only in recent times that they've been looked at and considered in a way that, you know, may give them some kind of veracity in terms of what we call modern science. And yet quantum physics, you know, the quantum hologram is saying all of this is what may very well be our reality. And it's just that we have been programmed out of accepting a lot of our experiences because of this particular way we choose to view our reality. When I suspect that we're looking at our reality through the eye of a needle, and we think we've got an idea of what the matrix is.
And so the question becomes, you mentioned this already, well, you alluded to this, how you separate a hallucination from a genuine experience. And on one level, you can measure it based on how transformative it is, which is certainly valid. But on the other hand, some people still might not accept that at face value and still challenge you. So how would you say, okay, these are actually genuinely happening to people? And from reading you and listening to your past interviews, you seem to suggest that it's the patterning, it's the consistency. And even though there are these kind of, between cultures, there are all these superficial differences, there's a core experience that keeps getting repeated. And I guess, what have you noticed to be the core experience, despite all the superficialities? Or maybe you can give some sense of that, maybe you can't, but what's your view on that?
Well, first of all, I want to be really clear that the nuts and bolts side is important. And, you know, the fact that many of them have maybe cited craft at different times, either on their own or with other people, where they've even got photographs and what have you. We also know it's a reality in terms of what's been, what the public is not told about from covert agencies that are hiding the fact there's been crash craft of very real physical bodies. Not all of them are interdimensional or extra dimensional or whatever. So these are very real physical things, you know, where they have been coming and have been taking people onto craft and what have you. There's a very physical component to a lot of these experiences. Waking up with marks on your body, strange triangular shaped marks, scars, certain types of, you know, shaved areas that you know, nobody can explain. There are often things like nosebleeds. People will wake up with a sense, very, very tired, a sense something's happened. And this, as I say, may not just be one person in the family. There may be two or three of them. People can go missing from their beds and then turn up outside with all the doors locked. You know, these are all very tangible realities to people. Missing time is a very tangible one where somebody goes on a journey, for example. The journey should take an hour. They start to see some strange lights. The car stops. And then they find they've lost 2 hours and they've got no idea what happened. These are, you know, things that can be recuperated, recouped, if you like, through, you know, hypnosis and whatever. But they're all extremely tangible. When you have an experience that more than one person is having in a family, for example, and they're all telling you the same thing. And I've regressed a family where they've all corroborated each other's experience on the craft, for example. That is all very real. The cover-up is very real. I mean, military people that have seen either retrieved craft or seen craft from Navy ships, from planes, from, you know, policemen, you know, the whole, that is the reality from a very understandable third-dimensional perspective. But the other side of this is in terms of the core experience is the fact that people make major life changes after a certain experience. They may have seen a craft with their family. For example, I'm now part of another organization called FREE, which is the Foundation for Research into Extraterrestrial Encounters. And this is an organization that is going to research with a multidisciplinary team. We have Dr. Edgar Mitchell on board as an advisory committee. We've got Dr. Rudy Shield, who is an astrophysicist. We've got other physicists. We've got engineers, we've got lawyers, we've got doctors, we've got social workers, certified psychologists, and we are now researching this in a way that would be very hard to dismiss from any level of our society. And the whole idea of this is to bring credentials into this, looking at out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences that people experience. So it's about human consciousness and the many ways that we have our lives changed. But primarily, the extraterrestrial encounter redirects people's lives. I mean, Ray Hernandez is one of the co-founders along with myself, and he's a lawyer, a Miami lawyer who is very proud to say he's seen a huge craft go over his house with his wife and daughter. There was very strange things occurred where his dog seemed to have been healed. And he's now so passionate that this is how FREE has come into being. We've got an amazing array of talented academics. One professor, Dr. Klimo, is actually, I think for 40 years, he's been a professor on consciousness, on the paranormal. Mm-hmm. He's written many different books on that. So the whole idea is now that we're bringing together a wonderful array of multidisciplinary individuals that know this is all related to human consciousness and to the shift in the way that we see our world. And then now what we need is a way to help people marry that with what they've been programmed out of. And I mean that not in a negative way, but the fact is that unfortunately, you know, our educational system and the way that we have been programmed really does limit people trusting that other aspect of themselves. You know, we're taught how to, you know, think first before we speak. Well, your multidimensional self actually offers you the information before you even try to think about it. But people don't realize that, you know, the intuitions that you get, the feeling that someone's going to ring you at a certain point. And it's not a way you can analyze or, you know. So what I found that happens is that this experience brings that right brain, intuitive quantum aspect of you into balance with its third dimensional, you know, grounding sort of planet Earth but it allows you to operate from both in a more integrated way. So in other words, it's saying almost, and I'll use the word that your soul self is saying, hold on a minute, you're only seeing part of the picture. There's another part that you need to see now, and this is going to help you operate on this planet a lot better. And it's sort of one way or another gives you a kickstart, whether it's through seeing a UFO, having a near-death experience, having, you know, sometimes a very profound grief experience where you lose somebody so special to you that it gets you exploring other things. We all have a different way of waking up.
Right.
And I call it a waking up. We wake up and we start to smell the roses and realize, you know, we're far more than we have been taught to believe we are. And many religions, sadly, don't help rather than that spiritual awareness, because they always want to give you rules to go by. And the rules actually limit you to exploring. This is my problem with a lot of them, is that on one level, yes, they can get you to start to see the world from a greater perspective on one level, but they have rules about how you should do it. Anything that has rules about how you should experience reality is, for me, is a problem, because nobody should have the right to tell you what your experience is. Nobody, I call it a personal discrimination. Well, a discrimination against personal reality. Hmm. We have no, you know, nobody has the right to tell you what your experience is or how you should experience it, because that's your world, your reality. That should be for you to assess and work out in the way that makes sense to you, rather than other people saying, well, that you can't have that. And that's not the way you should do that. And I'm just saying, well, no, actually, there's a part of you know that's exactly how to interpret your reality. Now you start doing it and stop listening to everybody else who's telling you. Start trusting yourself and start trusting that inner core that is actually telling you how to operate in this matrix that is your reality. And that's okay. That you don't have to explain yourself to anybody. So in other words, I'm a bit of a rebel when it comes to people telling me how I should experience or how I should interpret, because I think it should be the other way around. Everyone's their own guru. Everyone's their own teacher, their own student. You've got everything you need, I believe, when you come into this reality to understand it and operate within it through your own understanding and resources. But the trouble is, we are programmed out of trusting that. We're told the books know better than we do, or the gurus know better than we do, or the whatever. And actually, I'm sorry, but that's not the way I see it. I actually saying, look, we don't even know what reality is. How can somebody start to tell you how it is when they don't even
exactly.
know either?
Right.
So, yes, I'm a bit of a rebel, I think, John. Or I've become a lot more of a rebel since I started getting involved in this. So that's my transformative state, I suppose.
What's so important with what you're doing at Say Free is that, again, like, we need more transdisciplinary approaches to, I'd say, almost all subject matters. We need to be able to communicate between disciplines. And so often in academia, or even just in, you know, everyday business life or whatever, there's this over compartmentalization where we get very reductionist into these very specialized problems, and we get fixated into this tunnel vision. And we can't see what's behind us, to the left or the right above. We just see what's kind of right in front of our eyes. And yeah, we just can't see. And we're not even willing to go there because, again, if it's not put on a menu for you, or if someone in a spot of authority or socially sanctioned authority isn't telling you that it's something that you should be pursuing, you know, as herd animals, which is what humans are in so many ways, we get spooked and we don't want to get excommunicated from the herd. I mean, that is the scariest thing for anyone, psychologically speaking, is rejection. And so we're always looking for acceptance in this world. And sometimes the easiest way to get accepted is to follow kind of a disingenuous path. And that's kind of the path that, say, mainstream religion would give to you. Just follow these rules. Don't look at yourself. Don't try to discover that archetypal, transcendental, higher, transpersonal dimension to yourself, even though anyone that's kind of dug into this deeply for years comes around to the perspective of, yeah, that's kind of the reality of things. We are divided selves. We have this false ego, and then something deep down that is fundamental that is very hard to discover. And you do it through stuff like hypnotherapy. And maybe I'd like to dig into that a little bit, because I think hypnotherapy, either people don't have an understanding of it at all, or misunderstandings, and often it's criticized, it's not being reliable. So how did you come around to hypnotherapy? How do you practice it? Can you give us kind of an overview of it and maybe why some of the objections to it don't hold up in your perspective?
Well, that's a really good one because it's a very useful tool. And there's a lot of misconceptions about hypnosis, about, you know, you lose control and people can put in all sorts of horrible things and your life changes and not necessarily for the better because of it. One of the things I will say is Dr. John Mack did say about hypnosis, because of there's a lot of false information about the confabulation. People, you know, go and it's just their imagination getting carried away. They've read a lot on it, so they start to imagine that they've experienced things and what have you. That has not been my experience at all. And Dr. John Mack actually said that he trusted the information from the subconscious far more than he did the conscious mind, because the conscious mind will edit out anything that doesn't fit in with the consensus reality. Mm-hmm. So if it challenges it, then it will actually say, no, that can't be. Whereas the subconscious doesn't edit anything. It you know, doesn't act like that policeman. It actually says, this is what you've experienced, no matter how much it may challenge your understanding of reality, this is what you've experienced. And it unfolds like a tape. Now, for me, that has been absolutely the same thing. And if I've ever tried to get someone to see more than they'll see, they'll actually disqualify it. For example, if I'm, you know, with someone and I'm actually taking them to see something that happened to them, maybe they're on a spacecraft and what have you, I could say something deliberately conflicting. I could say, you know, what's in the corners of the room? And they'll say, there's no corners because it's a round room. I'll say, okay, so you're seeing a being now. They may say, look, I'm seeing somebody, a presence. I'll say, oh, what color's the hair? And they'll say, there's no hair. So, you know, even when you can do ask a leading question like that, which I never do, by the way, they will disqualify it. So my usual modus operandi is, what's the next thing that's happening? What's the next thing you're seeing? And that is what they will tell me. And often they will say things that they have told me afterwards. There's no way they would ever even imagine, because it's so beyond their imagining that they would be the best sci-fi writer in the business because of some of the things that they will explore when they're seeing things and experiencing things. Mm-hmm. That in itself, because they'll say to me, well, what's the difference between imagination and an experience? And I'll say, I'll tell you how clear it is. I said, for example, if I asked you right now, what does your room, your bedroom look like? Immediately in your mind's eye, you'll know where the bed is, where the window is. You'll see it in your mind's eye clearly, because that's your bedroom and it's something that you've slept in for hundreds of hours. If I said create a bedroom, you would think, oh, well, where would I put the bed? Where would the windows be? Where would the door be? It's a completely different process. Mm-hmm. And this is what happens with the subconscious once they go to that place where they'll go through to the age 7 or whatever. The first thing I'll do is say, what are you standing on? And they'll have to, through their subconscious, look down and see what they're standing on. And they'll tell me whether they've got footwear on or they haven't. And that will be as instant as that. You don't suddenly say, well, you know, I think I'll decide to stand on some wooden flooring. It's literally, it will come up as instantly as that. And when I say, what's in front of you, I'm not giving them any clues. They may say, I see a light. Okay. So what is that light like? Has it got a color? Has it got a feel? All the time, they are accessing that part of them that is showing them something. I call it their subconscious, superconscious, higher self. You can call it the part of you that knows. There is a part of you, if you've had an experience, that will know and understand that on some level. My job is to facilitate a safe way for them to explore it so they don't feel, and to keep them on track. Because if you try and do this with self-hypnosis, often your mind will go off in about 15 different directions, no matter how you try to be disciplined. Whereas a facilitator can actually take you to one particular track and say, we're going down this track, and keeping them on track. And that's my job. And the other way you know that they are in a state of hypnosis is often, if I've done a 2-hour session, to them, it will feel like 10 minutes. To me, it will feel like 2 hours, because I've worked very hard to get them to get the and they will come to me with the questions or the experiences they want to explore. And so all of it is unfolding for them, either in a sensing, feeling way or visually. And often it's visual. And they'll come out of it and say, well, I don't know what to do with that, because they will find maybe they've been shown more of their origins. Sometimes they actually go interdimensionally in their experience, for example, where they see other realities, other worlds, or they will see another lifetime where they see themselves as a different gender going through a certain experience that actually often relates to now in some way. Often it's an origin of a phobia. They'll actually re-experience the reason why that energetic imprint has stayed with them and brought through to this life. And we actually can move it. That's the great thing with hypnosis. You can get them to do a self-healing process where they can release that program. The evidence of that, I've had hundreds of times, the way that somebody's left me in a completely different place. They may even have come in really fearful. They have left me with a place where they're saying, I understand now. I understand I can work with this. And it can be life-changing. Even one session can be life-changing. But they've done it, John. I haven't. All I've done is help them to open the door into that part of them that knows, to experience whatever it is that is giving them the information they need to get on with their lives. And it's, you know, often that's why meditation is good, because we often get insights through that. And that is what often, you know, in religious circles, they're not so happy with, because they want to give you the answers and to keep you in that little world where they're still, you know, pulling the strings. Whereas actually, I feel that what we need to do is give people the freedom to explore however their psyche wishes them to understand their world and understand their reality. And if you can do that, it's the most empowering thing that you can help them with, if you like, because it helps them understand so many things in their lives.
This is a difficult question, but because so many of these experiences are quite personal, but at the same time, is there a message about maybe where these themes or these experiences are taking us as a species, as a collective? I mean, is there a collective dynamic to this, or is this really just sort of individual solutions and our personal growths in one of many lifetimes, or however you want to view that? I mean, is there an escape? I mean, what is the whole point of this?
Good question, and one that will be very hard to answer in 5 minutes. But what I would say is, ultimately for me, my conclusion at this moment in time, which of course can change as more information comes in, I've decided that my reality is an ice floe that I'm standing on, and it continually melts as I get new information. I have to recreate a new ice floe. So I've learned to deal with my constantly morphing understanding of reality. And, you know, I see it as a soul journey. I see it as we've come in to have a human experience, or an aspect of us, because we may be operating in many, many different realities for all we know. But I feel an aspect of us has come down, because when you do past life work, you often find that they come to a point where they'll tell you that they've chosen to incarnate in this lifetime. They've chosen their parents, their siblings, and worked out the kinds of challenges that they need to have to assist them to have a useful human experience. So, you know, they will actually tell me that it was before they came here as a soul. They've chosen what it is, their, if you like, their third dimensional reality experience, if you like, their virtual reality. I think that people will say, well, where's the choice in that? The choice is in your attitude to it, is how I've come to understand it. So when I've said to them, you know, when you're having this interaction with these intelligences and it's been maybe uncomfortable for you, and I will say to them, have you on any level consented to this experience? And with quite a majority of them, they will go back to their soul self and say, yes, because of this interaction, I have gained a great deal of understanding. And sometimes they'll discover the beings they're interacting with are actually part of their origin or their soul, their star family. So they will actually say, but they're my family. And I've come in a human form to actually work with them to assist humanity to wake up, to evolve. So that the biggest mission seems to be assisting humanity to move from a third dimensional reality to a higher dimension, is the way that they put it, fourth, fifth dimension. And that we are in that process now of evolving to a higher frequency is what they're telling me. And I use a lot of my research based on the amount of data that substantiates a particular theory or an understanding. And certainly a high percentage seem to come out with the same kind of information. And that gives it a veracity to me until something comes along that changes that. And as I say, I have to morph with the new information because it's so complex and so multidimensional. But the primary thing is that these intelligences, some of them are part of our, you know, soul groupings or our star families that are assisting this planet, and some have incarnated in on this planet to assist with this shift in human consciousness, is how they put it. And we've got the goodies and we've got the baddies, because we're in a duality and we've got to realize that all energy isn't loving, and that we have to understand there are self-serving energies and what have you. And that's part of how we learn, because if everything was wonderful and glorious, we wouldn't know what it feels like to be unhappy or to sad, and then we wouldn't understand what joy was. So it's a way of experiencing all of these different things in this virtual reality of our human experience. And I've got no idea whether that's the truth or not, but that's the closest I've got at the moment.
And I think some people might say, oh, the dangerousness is that you begin to undervalue reality. But for me, in reading these stories, and also, I guess, in my own experiences, the more you encounter the strangeness, and again, these transpersonal experiences, however you want to frame them or discuss them, I think they actually make you more sympathetic to the human condition, and more, even more in the world, an appreciation for what this experience is. It doesn't take me further away. In one sense, it does, but it gives perspective. It doesn't take me away. And I think that's really the fundamental and most important thing here, is that we're actually creating, or not creating, but this is helping to create a maybe more compassionate planet. And I don't see how that could be a bad thing, even if, say, the materialist wanted to say this is all delusion. Well, it's transformative. And so why don't we just play with that transformative aspect, even if you don't want to accept whatever other narratives you want to attach to it? Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And you know, the thing for me is that the more that I have come to understand what I call the soul journey, the more it makes sense then to do loving things. It makes more sense to appreciate we're all connected. That, you know, that just because someone's coming from a different culture or a different belief system or whatever, we're all part of this matrix of consciousness, aspects of the source, whatever you want to call that. And we're all playing a role, and we're all learning through that role. So it takes away a lot of the judgment that we have, which is the worst of all, I think, for limiting people and for understanding our connection to everything.
Maybe a direction I'd like to go, just because I have an intellectual curiosity in it, is the topic of indigo children, which are youths who have seemingly freakish emotional intelligence. Freakish has negative connotations, but they have very high emotional intelligence, in touch with something that gives them this wisdom that they're wiser than people five times their age and have accumulated all this life experience. They seem to come into the world with all this accumulated experience, or wisdom based on accumulated experience, which is impossible because they're only 6, 7, 10 years old, whatever. So what is your experience with those children, and what is your perspective on them?
Well, it's very much one of my major focuses now is what I believe that in each generation we're upgrading, if you like. There's an upgrade in terms of abilities and awareness. These children, and the parents will write to me, and teenagers as well, that will explain how they understand their reality. And it's completely different to most of my generations and whatever. I mean, only recently, you know, I was hearing of a 9-year-old that was telling me that he knew he came from Orion, and that he was dealing with understanding that his technology on that planet was very much in advance of what it is here. These children, one of them said to me that they were prepared to talk to me over Skype, because I do talk to some of them in different countries. And I said, why did you feel okay to talk to me? He said, and they said to me, because you have the right frequency. Now, I talked to a 16-year-old who contacted me saying that he knows, he remembers his past lives. He knows that one of them was on Mars before. And he said that I can actually build interstellar craft. And I said, well, how did you know how to do that? Is it a kind of download, you know, you were just given that? Or how else do you remember how to do it? And he said, oh, that I used to build them in my past life. And when I asked him, does he remember the language on Mars? And he actually spoke Martian, or he said this was Martian. you would think that was just one child or one young man who's a teenager, and even though he's unusual, until I spoke to another teenager of 16 in New Zealand who told me that he was from Arcturus and that he'd come to help the planet and that he could actually still speak Arcturian. Now, normally 16-year-old boys are on the computer playing video games and looking at the latest pictures of chicks. They're not doing yeah. that. You know yeah. what I mean? Coming out with languages. This young man told me that he could actually, part of the reason it was so difficult going to school was because he could tune into all the children around him. And if they'd had a very difficult time at home or had a very bad, any kind of abuse, he would actually feel it and know that they'd had it. They are often telepathic. They can actually, many of them have said they know what the teacher's thinking. I remember one 13-year-old girl telling me that she knew what her teacher was thinking, and what she was saying and what she was thinking were two different things, and what she was thinking wasn't very nice. So around these kids, you really do have to watch your thinking because they can tap into it. You know, many of them say, one 9-year-old in Northern Europe told me that she speaks three different languages and one of them heals water. In other words, it somehow acts on a molecular level through its frequency to purify water. Now, when you think, well, that sounds really bizarre, but if you're aware of Masaru Emoto, the Japanese scientist who showed how the crystalline nature of water can be altered by prayer, by music, by intent through mm-hmm. consciousness, it's not so bizarre at all. It's actually frequency, isn't it? It's about knowing how to interpret what these young people are saying. This 9-year-old told me that she had two non-physical beings that supported her. One was a blue being she called Imoko, and the other being was a little green being, and they took her places and they taught her about the origin of the species. They taught her a whole range of things to understand her reality now. These children will say, I went up on a spaceship and I learned how to levitate things, and will talk quite naturally about this to their parents. 7-year-olds, 8-year-olds, the parents write to me and they will tell me, you know, one gentleman who I'm writing an article at the moment is an engineer in Texas whose two children, one of them is 7, who says that she goes to Mars occasionally. She's taken to Mars on a spacecraft. She talks about what the Martians are like. She's actually pointed out pictures of ETs that her father showed her and pointed out the ones that were made up and the ones that were real. She actually knew the difference. She explained what she learned when she was on the spacecraft. The older son has actually worked out that he's from Andromeda. And he also talks about understanding frequencies. These are children that, you know, talking about things to do with dark energy. I mean, this 9-year-old told me that consciousness was made up of dark energy, and we work with dark energy so that we can do a lot of what we call the incredible things, such as healing, telepathy, clairvoyance. All those things work in that kind of a way. And when we realize that DNA actually has the ability to work through miniature wormholes, which is research done by some Russian scientists that actually say that language can actually alter the configuration of our DNA so that certain types of human language can heal dysfunctions or problems within our DNA. They also realize that they have the ability to work through miniature wormholes in a quantum effect, so we can contact and be in contact with other parts of the quantum reality. And that's why we can do a lot of these. We can tap into things through consciousness. So science is coming to the party, or at least future, you know, what I call the cutting edge science, is actually showing through the quantum hologram how we are able to do all these things supposedly called miracles, but are actually part of our nature. And these children are tapped into that. There's a number of scientists that I know are saying that these children have more of their DNA switched on, if you like, because we're only operating from 5 to 10% of our DNA. Mm-hmm. The rest they call the junk letter because they don't know what it is. But it seems like parts of the genome that have not been operating are now operating with some of these children. And that is why they can access more of the quantum reality than the rest of us. And that, I think, is tied into, and this is only a hypothesis because I've noticed it's the exponential increase in such things as ADHD, Asperger's, certain types of autism, possibly dyslexia. And my sense is that the reason there is a growth in these particular conditions, and many of them seem to have parents who've had encounters, for example, which to me is if it's an upgrade, why are they, you know, creating a so-called dysfunctional child? Well, actually, I believe it's to prevent these children being programmed into a limited, inaccurate third dimensional reality. And if you have these conditions, it's much harder to program them. And I think that is part of the purpose that they are in that particular way. But I don't know if that's correct, but it does seem to resonate with a lot of people. And I've had two scientists agree with that. One of them is Dr. William Brown, who wrote about this to me in a statement that I mentioned in my presentations. And another one in Europe, another scientist in Europe, who calls them letter people. And she says she's one, Asperger's, stroke, ADHD. And she said in our biochemical makeup, we need certain more minerals and vitamins to actually cope better because we are hypersensitive to sound, to a greater spectrum of visual acuity, and also even more nerve endings. So she is aware from a scientist's perspective there is an upgrade going on. Even at the moment, though, that isn't obviously being accepted by mainstream science. So what I try to do is when information comes to me, you know, about more of this, I look to see how I could qualify this or understand it in a way that makes sense to me, because I'm, you know, a lot of people may think I've lost, you know, lost the plot, as they call it in Australia. But, you know, I'm a former nurse and midwife. I'm pretty grounded and I need that left brain input. But at the same time, I can't dismiss when somebody comes to me with the most extraordinary experience, what right have I to say that can't happen or that can't be real when I know so little about what makes reality? Just in fact, the truth is, that's the same for all of us. What do we really understand of what reality is? We haven't got a dizzy clue, really, have we? And yet we have we have people telling us, oh, you can't have that experience because it doesn't fit in with my personal reality matrix. Well, sorry, mate, maybe you're just seeing a little bit of that and there might be a bit more that you need to learn about. So I'm learning about what may be part of the matrix. And I've learned now I can't dismiss any data, but what I will do is look for more data to qualify that if it looks as though it may be part of what I need to know about.
You mentioned synchronicity right in the beginning. Actually, this show in particular is part of what's called the SyncBook Radio Network. So our platform was founded on the idea of synchronicity and the relevance of synchronicity and taking it seriously as an ontological reality, that it's not a situation where everything that can happen does. These meaningful coincidences coincide to perhaps push you in a certain direction. And I guess if we're going to speak in a grandiose way about it, perhaps it gets you in touch with your destiny or that soul journey that you're talking about. So do you see that in a similar way? And if so, how has it kind of nudged you in this direction, if you can relate an experience or something like that?
Oh, I'm a great believer in synchronicities, because so many things that have happened in my life that have literally altered my direction. I mean, I make this joke, and I've done it several times, that when I was a nurse midwife, if you'd come to me and said, Mary, oh, by the way, in the future, you'll be traveling the world talking about aliens, I would have probably sent you to the nearest psychiatrist and said, they have some very good medication these days. That was 40 years ago, okay? Right. And how I've been directed in so many different ways in my life, it's, you know, I can't even begin to count to get me to the place that I'm in now. And even with not just synchronicity, some really anomalous events. And one of the strangest is when a gentleman phoned me who was in New Zealand, and he said, you know, he wanted to know more about my work and what have you. And we discovered over a 7-hour phone call, the longest I've ever had, that he had experiences, and it was very profound and very traumatic in many ways. He phoned me the next day and he said, look, Mary, I don't intend to have another 7-hour conversation with you, but I want to tell you this. He said, I was a bit worried about how much that phone call was going to cost me from New Zealand to Australia. So I rang up the, you know, the telephone company, and I said to them, look, you know, I had a long conversation last night to Australia. How much is the bill going to be? And they said, we have no record of that call. So make up your own mind about that one. Some of those kinds of things occur in my life now. So they're very big synchronicities in one sense. So what I'm saying is that I think that I almost feel everything is set up. And I've had lots of other anomalous events like that. But the synchronicities do, you know, I don't even try to orchestrate what's going on next. I have an idea of what I'd like the next few months or weeks to be. And then I say to the universe, whatever, as my grandson would say to me, whatever, Nan. Mm. And then I say whatever, because I never know what's going to unfold next. And I think I've come to the point where I just say to the synchronicity, the ones that are organizing them, it's called trust. Trust that, you know, you're being led to where you need to go. And actually very freeing, because you feel like, well, have I got to do this? Have I got to do that? Where have I got to be? And all the rest of it. And you give that completely away and you say, okay, guys, you know where I need to go. Just show me, you know, which mm-hmm. path it is that I need to go next. And sure enough, something will come up and lead you down whatever direction you need to go. So it's like you don't have to worry, you know, you just say, right, guys, whatever needs to unfold, get on with it, you know. And I always say, when people say to me, I think I've got something to do, and it's, you know, and I've felt it all my life, and I'm afraid I'm going to miss my mission or something or other. And I actually have a quiet chuckle over that. And I said, you know, do you honestly think that your soul is going to allow you to miss the bus? It's got you here. It's got you to this point now. Do you think at the last minute it's going to see you take a wrong turn? No, mate. You will find one way or another, even if you're not listening, your back will be against the wall, but you'll get the message ultimately. So just let it go. And often as not, they're on their journey anyway. It's just that it's not unfolded in quite the way that they had expected. So in terms of synchronicity, I love the word, because it really is, to me, it's another word for soul. It's your soul putting you on the next part of your direction, and the other aspect of you that's wiser than the conscious you, that's saying, right, this is where you need to go now.
Right, absolutely. And I think as Westerners, we're so obsessed with, again, this illusion of control, that we can control everything, that we can be masters of the universe. And synchronicity shows you the complete opposite, that everything is quite nonlinear. You're not in control. You're part of a larger energetic flow, and you're caught up in that, whether you like it or not. And so you can either try to fight it, or you can try to go with it as best you can, even though, again, there's always these event horizons of what we can know and not know. So like you said, there has to be a certain amount of trust, and not blind trust, but also, again, drawing on your experience and knowing also from other people's experience, kind of, there's a natural history of this to draw upon, and that you're not alone when you're going through this kind of strange stuff. Mm-hmm. And there are answers for people. Not one answer, but there's an answer for everybody in their own unique experience. They just have to look for it and start to kind of, again, shed that, whatever we think of as our false self, and not completely get rid of it. Just realize, hey, that's not all you. And there's more to you, and there's more to reality, and there's more to life. And I think synchronicity is one of the most accessible jumping off points, I guess, for people to start going there, because we can't all initiate a ET experience. I mean, I've never had one, and they seem like so spontaneous that I don't think that's possible. Like anything, you can't control this stuff, and everyone's chosen in different ways to do different things. And that's something not everyone's going to have. So the question is, okay, what's coming into your life that is showing you something different, and how do you interface with it? And I think synchronicity is one of the most pervasive, and therefore the most accessible sort of, you know, altered state of consciousness, or something that helps you, again, transcend that ego identity and see that there's more.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
This has been a great conversation so far, but I think we've been talking for a little over an hour, so maybe it's time to start wrapping up a little bit. Maybe, again, we've mentioned projects you're already involved with, but maybe you can remind us about those, and also something else that you might be working on or working towards.
Yes. Well, the main project is my second book, which is on the children and the teenagers, that, you know, from all the emails and contacts I've had with parents who have got these amazing children. And I just want to show via, you know, those kinds of interactions, just what the children are saying, how they understand their world, and what they feel is the future for us as a species, which I think, you know, the reason I love the children's information primarily is because they don't watch talk shows and they don't read books. So their information, it has a clarity that I really, really appreciate. So it's really on that. And if anyone wants to keep up to date, I've got a free subscription to my newsletter, which keeps people up to date and what I'm doing and what I'm about. But primarily, I want to, you know, I get lots of parents writing to me from all over the globe about their children. And the reality is they're everywhere. And I think they're going to be the ones that are going to lead us forward into understanding more of who we are. So I think we're living in very exciting times.
Mary Rodwell, thank you again for joining me. This has been a real honor to speak with you and very enlightening. So thank you again.
And thank you, John, for giving me the opportunity.